Thanks very much for the kind introduction, Walter. I think we've known each other long enough that it's hard to say that either of us are still young mathematicians, but nonetheless, it's a great pleasure and honor to be here, and I thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak this morning. So I also thank you for the honor of being the first speaker. The importance of this was impressed on me by a conversation that I overheard in the Pittsburgh airport one time. So I was sitting in the Pittsburgh airport. There were two guys sitting behind me who had obviously, one of them at least, had just come from a conference. And he said, you know, I gave the first talk at this conference. And before the meeting, the organizer came up to me and he said, you know, you're the first speaker. There's a lot resting on your shoulders. And the guy who was sitting behind me said, well, you know, I prepared. I think it's a good talk. It's relevant. And the organizer said, that's not what I mean. He said, just finish on time. If you run over, the whole schedule will be shot. So I'm aware of my responsibility not to run over by too much. But I do thank you again for the opportunity to speak this morning. So what I want to tell you about is joint work with Thierry Gallet from the University of Grenoble, and I'd also like to acknowledge the support of the U.S. National Science Foundation, who has supported my research throughout this project. What Gallet and I, the work of Gallet and I that I'd like to explain is the application of some ideas that are really ideas from finite dimensional dynamical systems, but in the context of the Navier-Stokes equation. And as we'll see, at least in two dimensions, this gives a very complete description of the long-time behavior of solutions of the Navier-Stokes equation. And even in three dimensions, we'll see that while we don't get the same sort of global understanding that we do in two dimensions, we do actually get sort of a better understanding of the existence and stability of what are known as the Burgers vortex and some of its variants. So the sort of idea, I guess if there was one thing I'd like you to take away from this talk, and that is that the idea of understanding the evolution of fluid flows can be facilitated by looking for coherent structures in the flow. And now in physical space, those coherent structures, at least for our purposes, will be vortices. But you can also interpret this in a sort of more mathematical framework and think of these coherent structures as geometrical objects in the phase space of the equation. So we'll look for things like invariant manifolds in the phase space for these partial differential equations and try to use that to sort of organize our understanding of the behavior of these solutions. So vortices are going to, as I said, be the sort of organizing structures we focus on. If you look at any of the very beautiful pictures of fluid flows, you see that vortices often appear in a variety of different physical flows. And what's going to be relevant for the talk this morning is that these vortices persist even after the flow as a whole ceases to be regular. So the previous picture you saw had a very strong regularity. Here the flow has actually become turbulent, but nonetheless you can still see that there are very clear vortical structures present in the flow. Now, the first part of the talk will be devoted to two-dimensional fluid mechanics, and you might say, well, that's a rather odd subject. We live in a three-dimensional world, but in fact there are aside from the sort of intrinsic sort of mathematical interest of the question, there are many physical circumstances in which you're interested in the behavior of a fluid in a domain in which two of the dimensions are much larger than the third. And so a classic example is the atmosphere, for instance. So there are many physical problems which are well modeled by the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation. And so in addition to the mathematical interest, I think there are sort of good physical reasons for studying these sorts of flows. One characteristic of two-dimensional turbulent flows is what's known as the inverse cascade. And that is that's a sort of shorthand for the following procedure, which is illustrated in these numerical computations from the fluid dynamics group at Los Alamos. So what's pictured here is the three snapshots of a numerical computation of the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation at successively later times. And the red and blue areas represent regions of either positive or negative vorticity. And I'll explain more precisely what the vorticity is in just a moment, but you can think of it as the tendency of the fluid to flow either clockwise or counterclockwise. Okay? So as you see, at the early stages of this fluid flow, the regions of opposing vorticity are very intermixed. They're small. They form small spatial regions. But as time goes on, there's this tendency for the number of regions of vorticity to decrease, but they grow in size. So there's a clumping together of the vorticity. Okay? Now, so these computations were done in Los Alamos. Those of you who are fans of the X-Files know that some things that happen in New Mexico just can't really be explained, so maybe this is one of them. But in fact, some things that happen in New Mexico don't happen anywhere else. But sorry. The last picture, it's not steady. If you follow further, in fact, even these vortices will eventually coalesce. Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean to say, it is the initial start, then the final stage, then the liquid flow becomes steady.
For these particular calculations, because of the boundary conditions, the ultimate state would be the zero or rest state. Okay. That's right. Yeah. So there's no forcing in these computations, and they're done on a fixed domain with periodic boundary conditions, which forces the total vorticity to be zero. So the ultimate state in these cases would be the rest state.
Okay.
So here are similar computations done this time in the Netherlands. And again, you see this very clear coalescence of the vorticity into a smaller and smaller number of larger and larger vortices. Now, we'll come at the latter part of the talk to three dimensions. And again, in either numerical or experimental computations of turbulent flows, you see that vortices play very prominent organizing roles in the fluid motion. Indeed, this famous paper that refers to these vortices as the sinews of turbulence. So they really are at the heart somehow of, or they're believed to be, there's of course no complete understanding of turbulent flows, but it's believed that somehow these vortices play an important role also in three-dimensional turbulence as they do in two dimensions. So what are the Navier-Stokes equations for those of you who don't work in fluid mechanics? Well, they're the partial differential equations that describe the evolution of the velocity field of an incompressible viscous fluid. So it's a coupled set of nonlinear partial differential equations. The first equation here is basically Newton's law. The left-hand side is the acceleration of the fluid. These are the internal viscous forces, and these are the pressure forces that act on the fluid. The pressure serves to enforce the incompressibility condition. Okay? So if you think about it, this is for d dimensions. We have d dimensions or d equations here and one more there, and that's exactly what we need because we have d plus one unknowns, the d components of the velocity and the pressure. Okay? So in principle, it's not unreasonable to hope that this system of equations has a solution, and indeed in two dimensions it does. So I've made these comments earlier, but I want to show you this coarsening behavior here in movie version. So again, these are the same computations from this group in the Netherlands, but this time you can see how it evolves in time. And you see there is this quite clear tendency of vortices of opposite sign to collide and then organize themselves into a single larger vortex. Okay, and so that's the procedure that we would like to explain mathematically.
Well, it looks like two things happen. One, similar vortices also.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. It's not only vortices of opposite sign. I should have said. Exactly. Yeah, so you're absolutely right. Vortices of the same sign can just as well merge as vortices of opposite sign. So here's a sort of poetic description of what we just saw. When little whirls meet little whirls, they show a strong affection, elope, and form a bigger whirl, and so on, by advection. Okay, so that's a somewhat poetic description of the phenomenon that we'll try to explain. So, in less poetic but more precise words, what I'm going to describe for you is a theorem that says that for the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation, if you take any solution at all whose initial vorticity distribution is integrable, then as time goes to infinity, that solution will approach a single explicitly computable vortex solution. Okay, so we, in the long time limit, we reach the sort of conclusion of this coalescence project, and so there's only one vortex left in the end. Okay, furthermore, at least for small solutions, we get a much more detailed picture, and we see that we'll show that in fact there are in the infinite dimensional phase space for this partial differential equation finite dimensional invariant manifolds, and the long time asymptotics of these solutions can be understood just by studying the system of ordinary differential equations that results when you restrict the PDE to the finite dimensional manifold. So it's one reason that the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation is easier to study than the three-dimensional equation is that if we look at the vorticity, which I've spoken of several times but now define more precisely, so the vorticity is just the curl of the velocity field, and the nice thing is that in two dimensions there's only one non-zero component of the vorticity. So in fact we can reduce this system of partial differential equations in two dimensions to a single scalar equation that I've written here at the bottom of the transparency. So the Navier-Stokes equation and the incompressibility condition reduce to this single scalar equation, which at first sight looks a lot like just some nonlinear heat equation. But there is a certain hidden complication, and that is that the velocity field itself occurs in this equation for the evolution of the vorticity. So we need some way of reconstructing the velocity field given the vorticity, and that we can do via the Biot-Savart law. So you know that if omega is the curl of U, then you can reconstruct U via this integral formula. So we have then, so the vorticity equation is a nonlinear scalar equation. The nonlinearity is quadratic in the vorticity, but it has unfortunately some very non-local properties due to this convolution in the Biot-Savart law. Now, the next thing I'd like to tell you, and this is something that's been known for over 100 years, is that there's an explicit family of vortex solutions of the two-dimensional vorticity equation. These are known as the Ossain vortices. So if you take the vorticity to be this Gaussian that I've written here in the middle of the transparency, and if you check the Biot-Savart law tells you that the associated velocity field is this one right here, then if you plug this in, you find that this is an exact solution of the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation. And given what we saw in these numerical computations, it's not unreasonable to expect that these vortices play some special role in understanding the long-time asymptotics. And that's what, indeed, the case. The next thing I'd like to point out is that if you look at the form of the vorticity and velocity fields of the Ossain vortices, it suggests that one way to sort of improve our understanding of the equation is to rewrite it in terms of new variables, because you see that x and t occur in a very special combination in this solution, namely as the so-called similarity variables x over the square root of 1 plus t. So let's rewrite our equation not in terms of x and t, but in terms of these new independent variables, xi and ta, which are chosen to reflect the sort of scaling structure of the Ossain solutions. We'll also rescale the vorticity, the dependent variable, in a similar way. So we'll replace the vorticity omega by this new variable w, and similarly for the velocity field. So if you take the two-dimensional vorticity equation and make these change of variables, you find that the equation now has the form I've written here at the top of the transparency, namely dw by d tau is some linear operator L minus, again, some quadratic nonlinearity. Now, the interesting thing about this change of variables is that the nonlinear term doesn't change at all, but we have complicated the linear term quite a lot. So that might not seem like an improvement. We've sort of made the equation more complicated before. But the reason that this is a more convenient form of the equation to study is that under this change of variables, the Hossein vortices now form a family of fixed points for the equation. Okay, so, and we know, I mean, if this were an ordinary differential equation, we'd sort of almost instinctively now just linearize around that fixed point and say, well, is it stable or unstable? What do you got? So, and, well, we're going to do the same thing here, okay? What we hope to do is take this equation, study the behavior near these Hossein vortices, and understand their stability using these ideas from dynamical systems. And it turns out, to give the punchline away right away, is that, in fact, these fixed points are globally stable. Any solution of the 2D Navier-Stokes equation with whose initial vorticity is in L1 will actually approach one of these Hossein vortices as time goes to infinity. So, as I said, our proof is based on ideas from dynamical systems. We first apply a sort of local approach in which we linearize about the Hossein vortex and study the spectrum of the linearized operator. That gives us a sort of very precise understanding of the local behavior of solutions near an Hossein vortex. And then for the more global picture, we appeal to the theory of Lyapunov functionals, which will tell us that any solution will eventually come into that neighborhood of the Hossein vortex where we can understand it via the linearization method. So let's start out by talking about the linearization. If we linearize about the fixed point A times G, so remember A times G was just one of our Hossein vortices. There's a whole family of these vortex solutions parameterized by A. And if we linearize about the vortex A times G, then we get the linear equation dW by dTa is this same linear operator L plus A times lambda, where lambda is this linear operator times W. So in the linear operator lambda, we have the velocity field associated with the Hossein vortex dotted with the gradient acting on lambda plus the velocity field associated with W dotted with the gradient of the Gaussian, which is the vorticity of the Hossein vortex. Okay, so we need to understand the spectrum of this linear operator L plus A lambda. So let's start out by trying to understand the spectrum of L. In particular, if we are interested in small solutions, those are in solutions close to a vortex where A is very small, the behavior of this operator ought to be dominated by the behavior of L anyhow. So studying L makes sense if we're interested in just small solutions, and it's also the starting point for understanding the stability in the neighborhood of arbitrarily large solutions. Now, as you know, whenever you want to talk about the spectrum of an operator, you have to be a little bit careful about what space you're working in. So we'll work in these weighted L2 spaces, so the space L2 of M are just functions that are square integrable when multiplied by this polynomial weight function. And so the larger M is, the faster these functions are forced to decay at infinity. Okay. Now, what's sort of interesting, although that operator L may look a little odd at first sight, Walter said that I was trained as a physicist. And one thing you learn to do as a physicist is solve the harmonic oscillator again and again and again. And so you start to see the harmonic oscillator everywhere. And indeed, this operator L is just the quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator in a somewhat unusual guise. And so as a consequence, we can guess right away what its eigenvalues are. They're just the negative half integers. That's the sort of classical point spectrum of the quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator. But in fact, because this, as I said, this is a harmonic oscillator in a somewhat funny guise, there's also a half plane of continuous spectrum. Okay, but as you see from the formula here, the half plane of continuous spectrum may be pushed arbitrarily far to the left by adjusting the weight in our function space. So if we choose M somewhat larger, that is to say if we enforce somewhat stronger decay at infinity, we can push the continuous spectrum into the left half plane. And so here's a sort of picture of the spectrum. It's a little hard to see back there, but we have these eigenvalues going off to minus infinity, and then we have this half plane of essential spectrum, but that half plane of essential spectrum could be pushed to the left, and so we just have an isolated family of eigenvalues of finite multiplicity, it turns out. You can compute their multiplicity. Indeed, you can compute explicitly the eigenfunctions associated with those eigenvalues, and again, not surprising, since this is a quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator, they're related to the Hermite functions. But again, thinking of this as we would if we were just approaching a finite dimensional dynamical system, what we expect now is that we have a center manifold associated with this isolated eigenvalue at zero, and then everything else approaching that center manifold. Indeed, we could construct invariant manifolds associated with any of these families of eigenvalues, and we would expect all other solutions to approach that invariant manifold with a rate given by, quote-unquote, the rest of the spectrum, wherever we choose to cut the spectrum there. Okay. Now, there are, I mean, since we're in infinite dimensions, there are sort of technical difficulties associated with constructing the invariant manifold, but at least in this context, those technical difficulties can be overcome. And indeed, we can show that for small solutions where it's okay to ignore the contribution of the second piece of this linear operator, the A times lambda, then indeed you can construct finite dimensional invariant manifolds. You can show that the long time asymptotics of the solutions are governed by the behavior of solutions of the ordinary differential equations that result from restricting the PDE to that manifold. And so we get really a very detailed description of the long-time behavior of the solution of solutions of small norm to the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation. But what happens now if we return to a study of solutions of larger norm? For that, we have to understand the effects of this second piece of the linear operator, this piece I called lambda before. And here, somehow, a sort of a miracle occurs. The first thing we observe is not really a miracle. It's just sort of functional analysis. Note that both terms in lambda are localized. Okay, so in the first term, we have the velocity field associated with the Hessian vortex, which is going to zero at infinity, which makes the effects of that term localized near the origin. In the second term, we have the gradient of the Gaussian, which is, again, very strongly localized near the origin. So that means in functional analysis language that the operator lambda is a relatively compact perturbation of the operator L that we studied a moment ago, and hence it's the essential spectrum of L plus lambda is the same as the essential spectrum of L. Namely, we have that half plane that can be pushed arbitrarily far to the left. Okay, so the essential spectrum doesn't move. That's not a problem. So what could happen? Well, these vortex solutions could become unstable because one of the eigenvalues moves into the right half plane. So now we have to ask what happens to the eigenvalues of sum L plus lambda. And this is where the sort of miracle occurs, because the first thing, let me remark that the zero eigenvalue is no problem. It never moves. You can show just by explicit computation that the Gaussian is an eigenfunction for the sum L plus A lambda for any value of A. So there is always a zero eigenvalue. The projection onto the zero eigenspace, it just corresponds to the fact that total vorticity is conserved in this equation. So that's kind of out of the game. So what we're really interested in are the rest of the eigenvalues, which are those which for L are minus a half or more negative, minus a half, minus one. So the question is, can any of those eigenvalues move into the right half plane? And the answer is no, and this is where the miracle happens, because again, if you sort of fool around with this quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator, you find that after another change of coordinates or in an appropriate function space, that operator is self-adjoint. And in that same function space, the operator lambda is anti-self-adjoint. And that's just, you know, integration by parts lots and lots of times. So what have we got? Well, we've got a self-adjoint operator whose spectrum is all to the left of minus a half. And then we add to that a skew-adjoint operator. Now, it's an exercise in linear algebra that if you take, say, a symmetric matrix, all of whose eigenvalues lie to the left of minus a half, and add to it an arbitrary skew-symmetric matrix, the eigenvalues will, in general, move off the real axis, but they cannot move to the right of minus a half. Okay, and so that means that for the sum L plus a lambda, regardless of how large a is, the eigenvalues are just zero, which we compute explicitly, and then other eigenvalues, all of which must lie to the left of minus a half. So it cannot go unstable, regardless of how large the vortex that we start with is. Okay. So this shows that the local stability is true regardless of which of the Hossain vortices A, G that we start with. So we can start with a very large vortex. Any small perturbation of that vortex will converge toward it under the evolution of the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation. And so now what we'd like to do to finish this picture is to show that if we take an arbitrary initial condition will eventually converge into that neighborhood where we can apply this local result. And for these more global results, we really have to turn to Lyapunov functions. And I'm going to talk a little less about these Lyapunov functions because I want to save some time for the three-dimensional results. So there are actually basically two Lyapunov functionals. The first Lyapunov functional is a very simple one, and it's related simply to the maximum principle. I remarked that the two-dimensional vorticity equation looks like a nonlinear version of the heat equation, and because of that, it's perhaps not surprising that solutions obey a maximum principle. And using that fact, you can, without much difficulty, show that if you take an arbitrary solution with an integrable initial vorticity, then the omega limit set, the long-time asymptotic limit of that solution, must lie in the set of functions which are either everywhere non-negative or everywhere non-positive. Okay, so you can't have an omega limit set which is someplace is positive or negative. And that, as I say, is simply a consequence of the maximum principle. Now, what's a little more interesting is that so this justifies restricting attention to either solutions that are everywhere positive or everywhere negative. And now, if you look again at the two-dimensional vorticity equation, and then, as someone pointed out to us, it looks a lot like a Fokker-Planck equation that's studied in kinetic theory. And kinetic theorists have developed, if you think about it, they're looking for a somewhat similar situation. So they're looking for convergence to a Maxwellian. Okay, which is again some Gaussian function. So, and we want to show convergence to a Gaussian vorticity distribution. And so we just borrowed one of the Lyapunov functionals that was constructed in kinetic theory. It's called the relative entropy in kinetic theory. It's just given by integrating W, the dependent variable, times the logarithm of W over the Gaussian. Okay, and it's relative entropy because it's relative to the Gaussian, which we want to show is the long-time asymptotic state. And then, again, a straightforward calculation shows that if you take the time derivative of this relative entropy function, then for positive solutions, the relative entropy is non-decreasing and, in fact, strictly decreasing unless W is just a multiple of the Gaussian. Okay? Yeah, well.
Well, Thierry
gave a talk somewhere in France, and somebody whose name has just gone out of my head, but we acknowledge him in the paper. Oh, I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name. He came up to Thierry after the talk, and he said, you know, that looks like one of these sort of Fokker-Planck equations. Why don't you try some entropy functional? And so we did. So his suggestion, which we... Oddly enough, not. Seems not, no. I think what threw people off probably was You see, in kinetic theory, it makes perfect sense to study positive solutions because they're probability distributions. But if you're thinking about vorticity, it just makes no sense at all to restrict yourself to positive solutions until you realize that, well, for long-time asymptotics, that's all that matters somehow, or solutions of one sign. And so, because, you know, this entropy function doesn't make sense if W changes sign somewhere. And so I suspect that's what threw people off, in fact. So, other questions? Okay. But now we're in business, because from the sort of LaSalle invariance principle, if you have a Lyapunov functional that is monotonic decreasing, then the long time limit must lie in the set of functions where it's where the Lyapunov functional is constant. And from this last part of the proposition, those are just multiples of the Gaussian. So this tells us, in combination with the previous result, that we must converge to one of the Hossain vortices. And indeed, if you put together the results I've described, we get a fairly precise description of the long-time asymptotics. Namely, if you take any integrable initial vorticity distribution, where A is the total vorticity, then the solution of the two-dimensional vorticity equation omega, and now I'm back in the original x and t variables, the corresponding solution of the two-dimensional vorticity equation will approach the Hossain vortex with parameter A given by the total vorticity, and we get a rate of convergence in any of the LP norms, and indeed you can show that this rate is sharp. You can construct perturbations that decay with exactly that rate. Yeah, Mary. Yeah, so there we used some results of Eric Carlin and Michael Loss, who showed that you have a certain all solutions, even if you only have initially integrable vorticity, have some decay at infinity at positive times, and so that gives us enough sort of compactness to show that that we actually do get we can hook up with these results we discussed earlier. So. It's not exactly like that. It's more that we just use it to get sort of compactness inside of L1. But for these results, we just choose M large enough to, so to speak, expose the zero eigenvalue. You can choose M bigger if you want to construct an invariant manifold of larger size, but if all you're interested in is the leading order behavior, you just have to expose the leading eigenvalue. So, is that okay? Other questions? Okay. Okay, so let's talk now a little bit about three dimensions. So, of course, in three dimensions, we can't expect anything like such general results, because even the question of whether or not you have a solution with general a smooth solution with general initial data is an open question. First of all, for solutions with small initial data, then we know that there are solutions, there are smooth global solutions. And again, we can describe their long-time asymptotics in terms of finite-dimensional invariant manifolds. So that goes very much along the lines of the two-dimensional description. Okay, but we'd like to look again at what happens around vortex solutions. And the problem is that the vorticity is no longer a scalar in three dimensions. So the three-dimensional vorticity equation is rather more complicated than the two-dimensional vorticity equation. It's a vector equation in particular, and the nonlinear term is more complicated. In particular, there's this extra term here, the second nonlinear term, sometimes called the vortex stretching term, and that allows for a certain amplification effect, which means you can't really hope for a relaxation back towards a single vortex solution. Yes? Ah.
But the second one is not relevant.
Okay.
If the Buckman were not there and there were zero, there's still the quote vortex stretching term, right? Which says that vortexes could be stretched as time goes forward. But that's a reversible equation.
Yes.
The vortex is could be stretched as time goes backwards too.
True.
So vortex stretching is a quote, a very funny word.
Okay. Yes. Those are both fair remarks. I can't really say anything to the second one. With regard to the first one, though, I should have mentioned this, and that is that since we're on an unbounded spatial domain, I can always scale away the vortex, the viscosity parameter. So I should have said that. So I'm always just going to choose my length scale so that the viscosity parameter is 1. But your second remark about the vortex stretching term is absolutely apropos, and I can't really say anything more about it. So.
It's a term.
It's there, and it causes problems. Okay, so lots of problems. So. Okay, but, whoops, I don't know what happened to my movie there. So let's try again. So, what I want to show you, though, is that in spite of this difference, there are sort of well-defined vortices in three-dimensional flows, and they tend to have some sort of stability. So this is a numerical simulation done in Lance Collins's group. The dark green regions are regions of high vorticity, and what I'd like you to observe is that these regions do exhibit a certain stability. They're advected along by the background flow, but they tend to maintain their shape and size as they drift along. And there's unfortunately in this computation some white stuff. Ignore the white stuff. It's the green stuff that's really of relevance for our discussion. Well, they injected some particles in the flow to see how they were advected by the background. Okay, so now these vortices obviously don't remain unchanged forever because they interact with the other vortices in the flow. But what I want to try and have you take away from that picture is that there is at least some kind of stability of the vorticity. They seem to have a relatively stable shape until they crash into another vortex, say. It's also, if you think about it, they're not quite circular in cross-section. Now, you might think that that's just a numerical artifact, but indeed, it turns out that's not the case. Now, remember that the Hossein vortex in two dimensions, even in the absence of any other effects, spread out with time. It was a function of x over square root of time. So it was spreading out. These vortices don't seem to exhibit that spreading quality, and that's because in three dimensions you can have a sort of balance between the vortex stretching term and the diffusion. Okay, so they offset each other, and you can have just a stationary solution of the 3D Navier-Stokes equation that does not spread in time. And the most famous such example was written down by Burgers, I guess at the end of the 40s or beginning of the 50s. So Burgers wrote down this explicit solution of the three-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation where you have a background field. So the first term here represents you should think of it as a background velocity field in which the fluid is rushing in the horizontal plane and then being shot out in the vertical direction. And then superimposed on that background field is this swirling field, U1, U2, which is rotating around the central axis of the background strain. In particular, the swirling velocities turn out to have exactly the same form as the velocity field in the Hossein vortex, but they don't spread in time. They're true stationary states, okay? Now, if you take the vorticity, take the curl of the formula I wrote on the previous transparency, you find that the vorticity of the Burgers vortex, again, has only one non-zero component, surprisingly enough, and that component turns out to be a Gaussian. Okay, so there are obviously here strong similarities between the Burgers vortex and the Hossein vortex, and that's just one example of a remarkable relationship discovered by Lundgren between the two and three-dimensional Navier-Stokes equations. So Lundgren showed the following. He said, take any solution, omega of x1, x2, and t of the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation, and construct the following three-dimensional vorticity field. So there's this function S of t, which involves, at the moment, arbitrary function gamma. You take that function S of t and the solution of the 2D Navier-Stokes equation and construct a three-dimensional vorticity field. And that turns out to be a solution of the three-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation and a background field associated with this heretofore undetermined function gamma of t. So there's a very close relationship between solutions of two- and three-dimensional Navier-Stokes equations. And so Galilei and I wanted to try and exploit what we had learned about a stability of two-dimensional solutions in this three-dimensional context. So in particular, if you look at Lundgren's transformation in the case where this function gamma of t is a constant, then you just recover the Berger's vortex. And in particular, I've just written down the evolution equation for the third component of the vorticity of the Berger's vortex. Okay, so the thing is that the operator that appears, so this is, so far, I've just taken the three-dimensional vorticity equation and plugged in the Berger's vortex, and what you see is that we really get, at least for the third component, just the rescaled two-dimensional vorticity equation. But I haven't done any rescaling. Somehow the rescaling, I didn't go to these similarity variables as I had to do by hand in the two-dimensional case. That's sort of done automatically by Lundgren's transformation somehow. Okay? So now we're in a situation very similar to the one that we studied in two dimensions, and indeed, many of our results will turn out to carry over essentially without change. Now, Berger's equation was used very soon after its discovery as a way of modeling turbulent flows. We saw in these numerical computations, and you see also in experiments, that these vortex tubes seem to be an important structure in turbulent flows. And so, for instance, all the way back at the beginning of the 50s, Townsend derived the energy spectrum for a turbulent flow just by assuming that the flow was made up of some random collection of Berger's vortices and vortex sheets. Then Lundgren, he discovered this transformation that I described just a moment ago, trying to extend Townsend's work and to, in particular, allow the background strain field in which these vortices evolve to be time-dependent. And then more recently, as I'll come to in the next transparency, there have been many further attempts to extend these sort of vortex modeling of turbulent flows. And so in particular, the famous paper of Safman and Robinson, who introduced stretched vortices. And so these are vortices where you give up the symmetry properties of the Berger's vortex. Neither the background strain field nor the swirling flow are any longer assumed to be axisymmetric. Okay, and they, Safman and Robinson, both constructed perturbative approximations for these vortices, and they did numerical experiments up to Reynolds numbers of about 100. That work was extended by Moffat, Kida, and Okatani, who developed formal asymptotic expansions, sort of matched asymptotic expansions, for the vorticity field of these stretched vortices in the limit of very large Reynolds number. And then Prochkin and Pullen studied the stability of these solutions with respect to two-dimensional perturbations numerically. So what's special here? This is a little bit of a funny thing. I mean, because of this Lundgren transformation, there is this natural relationship between two- and three-dimensional flows. But unfortunately, it can be sort of restricting as well. And the reason is that because of this relationship between two and three dimensions, if you want to directly take what you know about two-dimensional perturbations into the three-dimensional context, what you wind up studying are only perturbations that occur in the plane perpendicular to the vortex axis. Okay, so that's why there's this restriction in the Prochkin and Pullen work. And we'd like to get away from that because it's more natural, of course, in three dimensions to study fully three-dimensional perturbations. That's okay. So I'm adding all this to my time. So. Yes.
What's the range of that transformation? Meaning, is that any flow with the...
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer. Yeah, I simply don't know the answer. That's a very good question. Other questions? Okay. So what Galle and I want to do is study whether or not, using what we know about two dimensions, we can make rigorous some of the results that I described on the previous transparency, and furthermore extend those results to a consideration of fully three-dimensional perturbations. So we're going to study solutions of the three-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation in a non-symmetric background strain field. And I'm sorry, this is a typo. That should just be gamma, not gamma of t. For some asymmetry parameter lambda, and we'll look, first of all, for stationary solutions of the Navier-Stokes equation in which the vorticity has only one non-zero component. After we establish the existence of those solutions, we'll ask about their stability. Okay. So let me first of all just describe the existence. The existence turns out to be not very hard. We prove that there are such solutions provided the asymmetry parameter is not too large. And what's more, we find that those solutions exist for arbitrarily large Reynolds number. And the one sort of little bit tricky part in the proof is we actually show that the size of the neighborhood in the asymmetry parameter for which we have existence is uniform as the Reynolds number goes to infinity. You might worry that somehow that you lose the asymmetry as the Reynolds number goes to infinity. But we can show that indeed you get some uniform neighborhood as the Reynolds number becomes large. Question? Yeah.
Is it possible that
there is any Reynolds number? Oh, so that's a good remark. Yeah, so what do I mean by Reynolds number here? So it's conventional to regard the Reynolds number as the total circulation. So the total circulation is what people use in place of the Reynolds number in this context. Okay. No, very good question. So that's a little bit peculiar, but entirely conventional in this field. So how about stability? Well, we show that in fact for any value of the asymmetry parameter, if the Reynolds number is sufficiently small, then we have an asymmetric vortex solution. And what's more, that solution is stable with respect to fully three-dimensional perturbations. But it's stable in a funny way. It's a kind of orbital stability in dynamical systems language. That is to say, you start with some sort of three-dimensional vortex. You make a small perturbation. You converge to another three-dimensional vortex, but maybe not the one you started with. You can get a shift in the vortex caused by the perturbation. But we can prove you converge to some vortex solution. So I think I don't want to overstay my welcome here. So I'm just going to comment a little bit on the stability proof, if you will. So let's assume that we have constructed these three-dimensional vortex solutions. And let me explain a little bit how we prove stability, and in particular, how we handle the fully three-dimensional nature of the perturbation, because that's the slightly surprising point. So once we have these solutions, then as I say, if you're only interested in perturbations that lie in a plane transverse to the vortex axis, then that follows almost automatically from our previous results about two dimensions. So the real question is what happens to perturbations along the vortex axis. And just for simplicity, I won't work with these generalized non-symmetric vortices, but just the classical symmetric Burgers vortex. So the idea is we're going to take the vorticity to be the vorticity of the Burgers vortex plus a perturbation. And I've tried to indicate the Burgers vortex, remember, depends only on the coordinates x1 and x2, but the perturbation depends on x1, x2, x3, all the x-coordinates, and it's three-dimensional. Now, it turns out, for reasons that I don't have time to go into, that the critical component to understand is the evolution of the third component of the perturbation. And that, if you just write it down, is given by this PDE right here. So, again, I can't quite explain in the time available why it suffices to focus on the third component, but what I claim is that it does. And I also claim that there's nothing mysterious in this equation. All I did was substitute the form of the vorticity on the top line into the three-dimensional vorticity equation. Of course, what I have to tell you are what are the functions P of omega and N of omega. Well, L is the linear operator we encountered in the two-dimensional case. P is a linear term that comes from the interaction of the perturbation with the Burger's vortex around which we perturb. And that term will be small. This is where the limit, this is why our stability results are limited to small Reynolds number. That term will be small so long as the Reynolds number is small. N of omega are all the nonlinear terms, and those terms will be small if we make a small perturbation. Okay, so that's, those two remarks are simply to argue that I can restrict my attention to understanding the semigroup generated by the linear terms here, and then P of omega and N of omega you just handle in standard way with the Duhamel formula. Okay. So let's focus on this operator. It turns out that, again, this is related to the quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator, and we can actually compute an explicit integral representation for the semigroup generated by this operator. So what do we find when we do that? Well, we find that if your perturbation has zero average in any plane transverse to the vortex core, then the semigroup generated by that operator decays exponentially. But of course, an arbitrary perturbation won't satisfy this zero average vorticity condition. So how do we do that? Well, we just sort of by brute force make that work. That is to say, we take our perturbation and we write it as a function phi of x3 and t times the Burger's vortex plus a new perturbation omega tilde, where phi is defined to be the average of omega 3. So we put all the average into this term, and now omega tilde has zero average. So in particular, the perturbation omega tilde will now decay exponentially fast. But now we just sort of moved the problem. We have to figure out what happens to the evolution of the average. And here another miracle happens, okay? Because it turns out, and again, this is just an explicit computation and not an especially hard one. It turns out that phi, the average vorticity in each section, completely decouples from the rest of the flow. And I mean, this is not a linear approximation or anything. In the full nonlinear equation, phi just decouples and satisfies a very simple linear PDE. Okay, so and so we can solve that linear PDE, and what that linear PDE gives here, you can see it just gives the. Remember, I said that the perturbation causes a shift in the vortex in general. Phi just tells you by what amount the vortex shifts. That's exactly what the evolution of phi tells. Okay, so now we have actually a quite nice picture. If you take one of these sort of non-symmetric Burger's vortices and you make an arbitrary small three-dimensional perturbation, then at least at small Reynolds number, the resulting solution of the three-dimensional vorticity equation will tend towards a Burger's vortex, but with a shift in the total circulation. Okay.
Can you calculate that shift from the...
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, it's right here, basically, is what it is. You convolve with this Gaussian kernel. You take the initial average vorticity in each section, convolve with that Gaussian kernel, and then evaluate at zero. So it's at least in principle an integral that you can compute. So, yeah. Other questions? Okay, so just to leave you now with the sort of summing up. So these coherent structures, whether you think of them as vortices in physical space or invariant manifolds and things like that in sort of phase space, are, I hope I've convinced you, important organizing features. In two dimensions, they actually allow a quite complete description of the long time asymptotics. In three dimensions, if you're content with studying small solutions, you again can describe the asymptotics in great detail. And even if you don't want to be restricted to small solutions, they still give some insight into the existence and stability of these non-symmetric versions of the Burger's vortices. And here, if you'd like to read more, the sort of references to Thierry's in my paper. Thanks again for the chance to be here.